Welcome to the View My Seats podcast with John Lord. My guest, Eno Saris, is a fantasy baseball writer for Fangraphs, whose recent article, Fantasy Baseball is More Real Than You Think, analyzes whether or not fantasy baseball is too far removed from reality. Eno, welcome to the View My Seats podcast, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
What was the final verdict? Is fantasy baseball operating in fantasy land?
No, actually, I was surprised by how close it was. I mean, you know, you basically have almost 90% lockstep when it comes to hitters, the old 5x5 stats, and the more modern stats we have today. They're right there, you know, 80 to 90%. So it is really important if you're running a real life team. That 10% is hugely important. I mean, that's how you advance your team. That's how you find undervalued players and so on and so forth. But, you know, to have something that's come 10% in 20, 30 years that fantasy baseball's been playing, it's kind of amazing that way.
So if how we value fantasy baseball is not altogether different from how baseball is actually valued, why do so many people believe that there's this major gap between the two?
Well, I mean, it's really a question of how well you are measuring things, what you want to measure. So, for example, RBI. RBI is a weird stat because it takes teammates on the base paths. It takes a good lineup around you. It takes a contact hitter. There's a lot of things it's measuring. It's measuring how well you make contact and all sorts of different things. And so we use RBI. There's information in RBI. But if you can separate those out into, you know, better things like contact rate, you know, and things that aren't as dependent on the people around you, then you get better information out of, you know, the same occurrences on the field. So that's important when you're running a team. But for us, it's kind of funny that RBI, as much as we make fun of it, RBI still does capture something about the player's talent and what happened on the field.
Do you find that your conclusions kind of, sort of, bring into question the value of sabermetrics in baseball?
I don't think so. I think it's you know, it's just a question of scale. I mean, if I can find something, if I'm a baseball team and I can find a way to add a run per game, you know, not a run per game, but I meant that in a sabermetric way. But if I could find a way to get 10 runs over the course of a season out of my roster, 10 runs by, you know, not bunting, or 10 runs by changing this or doing batting practice differently, these are little things that add up over the course of 162 games. 10 runs equals one win. And one win seems like maybe not that big a deal, but if you didn't put a lot of money into it, then it's a good return. And one win is now separating guys from the second wild card and not being in the playoffs. So, and second wild cards can win everything. So when you're running a baseball team, every little tiny bit counts. I think what I just wanted to say was, hey, don't pet fantasy baseball players on the head. Don't sort of denigrate them. There's a little bit of that. You know, now I'm in the clubhouse a lot more interviewing players, and there's definitely a line that, you know, PR professionals and teams have drawn, which is, you know, we'll let you in if you're reporting on real baseball, but if you're a fantasy baseball writer, there's no reason for you to be in the clubhouse. So I think I just kind of wanted to be like, hey, you know, it's not that different.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that with the conclusions in your article, there perhaps is a way to kind of stem some of that backlash that the fantasy and sabermetric community is facing from, I don't know if we want to call them baseball purists, people in the locker room, however you want to classify those people that kind of look at you kind of askew and think you're coming from a different place. What I took away from a lot of your article is that really the way fantasy baseball looks at baseball is not altogether different from the traditional ways.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I did point out the relief pitching is a really interesting thing for me because, you know, by our sabermetric numbers at Fangraphs, by wins above replacement, you know, almost any reliever contract that's signed is a bad deal. I mean, even Dave Robertson, Andrew Miller, these guys, because relievers are so volatile year to year and because they pitch so few innings, you know, we just haven't been able to find a way to make these contracts make sense. And even Papelbon, who's been pretty good, even Jonathan Papelbon, who's been pretty good, has not been worth his big old contract. So by our numbers. At the same time, you know, and in fantasy, we make fun of the save stat and we think it's, you know, not a great stat. But if you look at the people who accrue saves year to year, they are, you know, consistently good relievers. These are relievers that are good year after year. And the save stat allows us to kind of value those pitchers correctly in a way that the marketplace values them. Because if you look at GMs, they're actually paying, you know, $10 million a year for these closers that have shown themselves to be established closers. So the market says, you know, relievers are worth something. Closers are worth investing in. And our stats are saying they're not. So there's actually a way that fantasy is maybe ahead of the stats. Maybe we'll find a way to better evaluate relievers and sort of show what the market is doing. But in the meantime, fantasy values closers more than our numbers, our sabermetric numbers do.
I'm really glad you just mentioned that as far as fantasy perhaps being ahead of advanced statistics, because I get this sense with fantasy baseball that there's almost this chicken and egg type scenario where you look at the emergence of sabermetrics and you look at the increasing popularity of fantasy baseball, and I'm often left wondering, well, what came first? You know, what came first? Was it fantasy baseball that led to the rise in sabermetrics, or was it the sabermetrics that led to the rise in fantasy baseball? If you had to take a stab at that chicken or egg type scenario, what would you say?
Well, here we go. I don't think people know this, and I don't think that he'll get mad for me for saying this, but this is really interesting. Fangraphs was started by David Appleman in order for him to win his fantasy leagues. And I don't think a lot of people know that. It's sort of an offset joke in our offices, our virtual offices. But yeah, he wanted to dominate his fantasy leagues, and so he started it first as a little project to sort of gather all the best stats that were out there, and put them out there publicly available for free, so that players could do better in their fantasy leagues, so that he could do better in his fantasy league. So ironically, he said that the rise in Fangraphs has made it harder for him to dominate his own leagues, because now everyone else has the information. But I do think that there needed to be, you know, the front offices were always going to be interested in whatever research they could do, in order to, like I said, shave a runoff here or there, or do whatever they could to win. I mean, they were always going to do that. But the thirst, I think, from the crowd, the thirst from, you know, advanced baseball fans, I think comes hand in hand with fantasy baseball, because, you know, what they're trying to do with sabermetrics is value players correctly and do a better job of projecting players and finding the best players going forward, and that's basically the same mantra that fantasy players have. They want to find the best players going forward, and so I do think that those definitely came hand in hand. And in the case of Fangraphs, you know, we know which one is the chicken and the egg.
Yeah, I guess so. Now we do. You mentioned earlier that there's kind of this, I like how you put it, and I think you said this in your article as well, which is that there's kind of this 90% convergence, right, mm-hmm. between, you know, fantasy baseball, the way we value fantasy baseball players and the way baseball players are truly valued in the game. And you also mentioned, I think this is really astute, that 10% is where, you know, front offices, that's kind of the realm that they inhabit. Could you take a guess at what's going on in that 10%? Have you at Fangraphs, and perhaps there are other websites out there that have tried to tackle what that 10% is that perhaps fantasy baseball can't quite grasp yet?
Yeah. I at the winter meetings, I did try to ask a few guys, you know, what, you know, where are we the furthest off? And I guess there's proprietary data that we haven't seen yet. And we may see it in the future, but there's some data basically on where fielders are. Some of it pertains to defense, where fielders are to begin the play, how far they run. We've seen some beginning of it. called StatCast. It's coming out from MLBAM. We'll see some of it this year, where they'll start tracking routes where runners, you can see how far they've run and where the ball went and all that. That stuff will really help value defense, because honestly, right now, we're doing our best when it comes to valuing defense, but it's hard. That's maybe not super relevant to fantasy players, but I do think in another way that information will help us with something that every fantasy baseball player knows, this stat, BABIP, batting average on balls in play. Everybody knows that there's some magical component on the pitching and hitting side that's luck, and that once the ball's in play, there's a certain percentage of likelihood it's a hit, but we don't know what that percentage is all the time, and we're left guessing what a line drive is. I mean, this is what I tell people all the time when they want to tell me about line drive percentage as a stat. I say, go watch a game and tell me how many line drives you saw. And make your friend sit right next to you, and you make your own notations, and then you compare notes and say how many line drives you both saw. So
there's going to be a discrepancy.
Yeah, a real big one. So yeah. I think that's why you see line drives year to year are very noisy. And so what I think probably is going on in front office is a little bit more definition of a line drive in terms of angles, velocities, that sort of thing. Because you could probably define a line drive in sort of vertical angle and velocity, and then you would be taking a lot of the guesswork out of it. So I bet that's going on in front offices, and we don't see it as much.
How about, and you've alluded to this in some of your earlier work, but how much of the 10% could be perhaps dealing with the ballpark that you play in and building a team based on the ballpark that you play 81 of your home games in?
You know, I think it's a great point. The Pirates seem to be the best at this. I think that the Pirates have a strong philosophy when it comes to using the two-seamer a lot, getting ground balls, and it actually makes sense because in some ways ground ballers are prone to a few more homers per fly ball. It has to do with pop-ups. I've seen some research on this that basically fly ball pitchers, like you think of your Jared Weaver types, they get a lot of pop-ups because they're living high in the zone and they're throwing the ball high in the zone. Ground ball pitchers throw everything low, and when it is a mistake, it's right in the wheelhouse of where hitters are sort of dropping their bat head right now. So, you know, sometimes they'll have a higher home run per fly ball rate. So the Pirates do have that problem, actually. They have a slightly higher home run per fly ball rate than you'd expect, but it's way more pronounced on the road. And so what they've done is built a ground ball staff in a park that'll suppress the home runs per fly ball, and then, you know, when the Pirates go on the road, you know, it's a little bit worse, but they at least they play 81 games at home.
That's interesting. So the two-seamer compared to the four-seamer, and if you miss with a two-seamer, that miss is going to be up in the middle of the zone, because normal action with a two-seamer is to dive down, correct? And if you miss with a two-seamer, that's going to be right over the heart of the plate. And so if the Pirates are teaching primarily the two-seamer, their misses are going to be down the middle of the plate?
It's also just about focus. I mean, if you tell – they focus on low in the zone. So if you focus on low in the zone, you're throwing everything low in the zone, down and in is actually a homer area. I mean, that's – you know, down and in is like where batters love to get the pitch. Right now, especially lefties, that's a huge – home run for fly ball hot zone is down and in. So if you're focusing down, you're most of the time going to get a ground ball, but when you don't get a ground ball, you're getting one of those fly balls that's more likely to be a home run. You know, you're getting a golfed pitch. Whereas if you're up in the zone, you know, there's this one spot that's really great for pop-ups. And Matt Cain was really good at that. Jared Weaver was really good at that. You hit that spot and you get a pop-up. It goes right straight up and it's almost like a strikeout anyway. But if you miss, you know, you can give up homers too. It's a question of philosophy, but, you know, there are more weakly hit fly balls up in the zone than down in the zone.
And building your team based on your ballpark can also backfire. If you look at what the Mets have tried to do this last decade in Citi Field, you know, their team now is constituted around their strong pitching staff, and I know they're moving their right field fence in again, but the thing was with the Mets was that, you know, the larger ballpark should work in their favor when they have a strong pitching staff. how it actually worked out, though, was it actually hurt the Mets' offense more than it helped the Mets' pitching staff.
Yeah, yeah, that one's an interesting one to watch. You see, I think generally extreme ballparks are tough to win in because you build it for your home team and then you are terrible on the road. I mean, the Rockies have a crazy hard time with this. Or you try to just build a good team and you try to figure out, you know, I think that's the way to do it, is just try to build a good team and try to figure out what you can do on the edges. But if you watch San Diego, Seattle, New York, these were some of the most extreme parks, and they've all moved their fences recently. And I've seen some work that suggests that just extreme parks are tough on you. And, you know, from a fantasy angle, it is interesting. If you think about a guy like Corey Dickerson, you know, if I could give you the whole Colorado's offense for a rotisserie league, you'd be happy with that. But if it was head-to-head league, you know, you'd have some real hard days because, you know, when that Rockies offense goes to San Diego, they're useless, you know. So, you know, it is interesting to think about park factors. And then we as fantasy players are always thinking about that because, you know, Pablo Sandoval, what is he going to do? What is he going to... You know, is he just going to hit for a good average and the same amount of home runs? You know, is he going to pepper the green monster? What's he going to do?
And I think there are a lot of questions about players, you know, on a year in and year out basis. And one of the things, I don't know if this irks fantasy players, but, you know, a lot of fantasy players, you have a successful year in fantasy, you think, wow, you know, I can do this. I'm an evaluator of talent. I know how to put teams together. And I would say your findings, in a way, do give some credence to that idea, you know, this whole idea of 90% convergence. And we talked a little bit about what that 10% is. And you're probably not going to like this, but I wonder if a portion of the 10% is, and this is something that, you know, people scratch their head about all the time, but could that 10% be perhaps something called chemistry? That it's impossible to really put a value on the chemistry in the clubhouse? I mean, there's no way for fantasy to do that. And could that be where that 10% kind of lies?
You know, I've only been in the clubhouse 2 years, and I haven't been in every clubhouse. But the one thing that strikes me about chemistry is that there's a lot of different ways to achieve it. And I think, you know, everybody talks about the athletics as maybe not having it because of a certain, you know, they haven't been great in the postseason, you know. And, you know, they move a lot of players around. But Bob Melvin is amazing at what he does, and he keeps everyone happy even though they're all platooning. And he's just a really good communicator. He's just really good at keeping them happy about themselves and their role on the team while also putting everybody in the right places. And then, you know, on the other side, Bruce Bochy is just a really calm guy, you know, really quiet, calm guy who has the respect of the clubhouse, isn't really the same kind of communicator, but... I mean, just the two of those clubhouses have achieved their own kind of chemistry in completely different ways. I mean, you go into the Giants clubhouse, they're all just, you know, veterans. They're all just working hard to be the best they can. Buster Posey leads that by example. Then you go over to the A side, they're all young guys. A lot of them have been cast offs from other organizations. They're loud, they're boisterous. They're happy that they've gotten a chance, and they're happy for different reasons, they've gotten chemistry for different reasons. So I agree that there is some amount that chemistry matters. I doubt it's 10%, and I would say that it's hard to manage, you know, if you are sort of a front office person. It's really hard to manage chemistry because you don't know exactly how this one player is going to come in. A.J. Burnett, some people really hate him. I saw him as a really great glue guy in the Pittsburgh clubhouse because he went and made fun of every different group. He went over to the young guys. He went over to the old Hispanic guys who were playing cards and made fun of them in bad Spanish. And he, you know, and by doing that, he became this guy that they didn't collectively hate, but, you know, they collectively joked with. So everyone was somewhat tight with him, and that kind of brought the whole room together. So, yeah, and, you know, might put A.J. Burnett on the Giants, and the Giants would be like, who is this guy? You know, who is this joker? You know, get him out of my face. So,
yeah, it sounds like a lot of clubhouse chemistry comes down to the leader, who you have leading the team, the manager and the veterans. But if we were to have some fun for a second and to try to come up with a metric to measure chemistry, I wonder what that metric would look like. You know, what kind of what do we put into the equation? Do we put in something like, you know, how many Ubers are these guys sharing after a game? You know, how many separate little card games are taking place in the locker room? I mean, there really is no way to measure chemistry when you're factoring in the value of a team.
Exactly. I mean, it's something that's really hard to put in the numbers. But I mean, if we were going to do it, card games is on there. A number of separate card games. You know, that would the more separate card games you have, the less unity there is. I've seen some mammoth card tables, and then I've seen some structured ones. I would also say number of bilingual speakers probably is a big deal. You know, language barriers exist, and so I've seen a guy like Martin Prado in Arizona was a big deal because he worked hard and he spoke both languages and hung out with both sides of the table.
See, what I love is I think that 10%, you know, can be attributed, a lot of it can be attributed to chemistry. And I think take what Paul Molitor in Minnesota is doing, for example, you know, getting rid of cellular devices, iPhones and iPads prior to games. I think that shows you the importance of chemistry when it comes to baseball. So that's another example of, you know, how we could come up with a metric for measuring chemistry. You could talk about, are the phones out in the clubhouse?
Yeah, you know what? Kyle Gibson did that when he got to, not Kyle Gibson, sorry.
Kirk.
Yeah, Kirk. Sorry, I'm always thinking of the future. Kyle's got a good slider. So Kirk, when he got to Arizona, he did the same thing, and I don't think it went over well. I mean, number one, I think for good chemistry might be happy players, and so that's why some people say, you know, good chemistry comes with wins.
Right.
Sometimes it comes with comfort. So, you know, the Giants kind of went the opposite way. They just revamped their clubhouse, and then everybody's home locker in the Giants, they've got their own charging station so that they don't have to come together to charge at the one table where everyone's got their iPhones out. So every locker has their own charging station. Every locker has a little wing that they can pull out and get a little bit of privacy. It's a different mode. I mean, some people want everyone to come together and slap each other in the butt, and then some people want, you know, just everyone to feel comfortable. You know, and feel like they're part of it. You know, a part of a good workplace. So it's a, you know, there's all these different ways to do it. It's yep. You know, it just comes down to, you know, your actual players, I think.
And I mean, I bet if you talk to the players about chemistry, how much chemistry matters, they'll give you all sorts of different answers. Some will say that it does matter. Others will say, you know what, we're paid professionals. Our job is to go out there and play baseball, and chemistry doesn't matter. So I bet it depends on who you talk to. Switching gears a little, I wanted to just talk about fantasy baseball in general. And as fantasy baseball continues to get more and more popular, I'm wondering, do you find that fantasy baseball is helping to diversify the general baseball audience? And what I mean by that is fantasy baseball attracting other people to the game of baseball, people that wouldn't be interested in baseball if there were no fantasy baseball? Particularly, I'm thinking about younger fans, because you know that baseball has an issue of attracting younger fans, and a lot of that is due to the pace of play. Do you think fantasy baseball can help there?
Oh, I definitely. I mean, I think there's one thing that didn't used to happen a lot that is happening more now that you can directly attribute to fantasy, which is watching games that don't include your hometown team. And you start to become a scout and want to watch the players that you picked that day or that you picked for your team. And I think, you know, I've seen it happen to myself in football where I'm not as much of a fan. I'll watch a random game sometimes to see how my running back is doing. So I definitely think that it adds viewership. It adds people in an interactive way. And I think the DFS is a big deal, because daily fantasy sports, in allowing someone to play fantasy baseball without the 162 game commitment, I think allows for a little bit more toe dipping in the water, where you can say, okay, I want to know more about baseball. I want to know more about these players. I want to play some DFS, but I don't really want to set my lineup every night for 180 games. So 180 nights. So I do think that'll help bring some people in. I do.
Do you think? I'd love to know the numbers on this, but are the percentage of fantasy baseball owners are those? Is the average age skewed younger or older? Do you know by any chance?
I do not know, but I would guess older. DFS, I would guess skews younger.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see some sort of workup on who's playing, you know, age, race, ethnicity, gender, all those things, because I'm sure that's information that Major League Baseball they probably have. Because they understand how to enhance their product. They need to make sure that they continue to attract to fantasy baseball owners.
Yeah, that's true. There is an interesting thing going on, though. There are two different modes. I mean, DFS is really, you know, what's happening tonight. I want to know what's happening tonight, where, you know, I think that there's a rise of dynasty and keeper leagues. At least, you know, my site, Fangraphs, our fantasy section, does a lot of work towards keeper and dynasty leagues. And, you know, you get really dedicated readers and owners in those kinds of leagues where you keep players forever. And I think those two modes, you know, offer a lot, you know, beyond what was the traditional sort of we're just going to play this year out fantasy game, you know. Between the two, I've noticed, you know, my readership tends to be fairly young. You know, we talk about a lot of the same music in my chats. On a weekly basis, and I do think that there's something about like your first job out of college. A lot of times it's at a desk with internet all day, but not necessarily a ton of responsibility. And yeah. I find a lot of those guys are my readers.
There's no problem with that.
Yeah.
Do you find that in your experience now at the ballpark, do you find that stadiums are starting to tap into the popularity of fantasy baseball?
Oh, for sure. I mean, at least the social experience. And AT&T, San Francisco was one of the first parks to have free internet for everybody, free Wi-Fi at the stadium. And they've augmented this now with a lounge where tweets go by, you know, on an LED screen. Particularly around All-Star voting time, there are player-based pieces of information and social network type stuff that goes around and tweets from players and stuff like that. So they're definitely trying to. I think they love fantasy. I think baseball loves fantasy baseball. Manfred just recently, the commissioner just recently said some things about how fantasy baseball is important to the popularity of baseball itself. But they also have to walk a line because, you know, daily fantasy baseball is a little bit closer to betting. And, you know, if a ruling goes here that way or this way, DFS is not maybe on the most solid footing, you know, compared to regular old fantasy baseball. So I think that they don't want to go all in on, you know, daily fantasy sports until they feel like it's, you know, completely legal in all states.
Right. I was going to say, taking that in consideration, I don't think we're all that far away from being able to challenge other people in the stadium to some sort of, you know, a fan duel, if you will, as far as for that day's fantasy. Mm-hmm. You know, but like you talked about the legality of that, where Major League Baseball can't fully embrace that just yet. But as a lot of people talk, it's probably not that far away in this country.
Yeah, there's an interesting game out right now, Fanamana. You actually are picking players while the games are on, and I think that one could totally be used to do exactly what you're talking about. I mean, you're playing a game with outs and innings, and it seems like baseball, but you're picking players that are playing right now. It's not as much like regular DFS. You have to set your lineup before the game.
Yeah.
So there are sounds like a
series of prop bets.
Yeah, exactly. It really is. But don't use that three-letter word.
No, I will not. One of the other articles you worked on recently, which I found really, really interesting, is that there's a stigma that faces shorter athletes, shorter players, and it faces quarterbacks like, you know, Russell Wilson and Drew Brees, and it also in baseball there's a stigma against shorter pitchers. And you wrote an article recently about how that stigma can be debunked when you just take a look at two teams, the Oakland A's and the Philadelphia Phillies. Do you mind explaining kind of how the stigma of the shorter pitcher doesn't necessarily apply in the case of the A's and the Phillies?
Well, they have the biggest disparity. The A's over the last 5 years have given maybe, I think, 50,000 more pitches to pitchers under 6'1" than the Phillies have. So just, and that might just be a virtue of what their staffs have been like recently. But the A's pitching staff changes every year, so there really is something to it. And if you think about the guys that they've traded for and gotten, Jesse Hahn, Scott Kazmir, a lot of these guys are shorter guys. And I think that they've identified this as a potential market inefficiency. But what I find really interesting about it is that there might be an actual argument for it on the – if you have bad numbers coming in. Let's say you got a high school pitcher you're looking at or a Dominican pitcher or something. I think in that case, I think you want the guy to be big because you want him to be athletic and you want him to grow and you want him to put on weight and you want him to put on velocity. And you don't know if you can trust the numbers he's putting up in the leagues he's been in so far. So the less you can trust the numbers he's put up, the more it might make sense to look at their bodies and their body types. But I think especially once you've got a college pitcher or you've got a pitcher with any minor league track record, then I think all that stuff goes out the window, really, because it becomes about what they're doing now. Marcus Stroman.
Yeah.
Marcus Stroman was great in college. Marcus Stroman did everything he wanted. He had great numbers, great stuff. There's no reason to take Marcus Stroman any lower than the top three of that draft. And, I think he fell probably because he's a little bit short, and people still think like they thought about Scott Kazmir when they traded him away from New York. They still think, oh, he's too short. He'll fall off early. He won't do this. He won't be able to strike people out. So I think there's a certain moment when, it's irrelevant how tall the guy is. If he's pitched in double A, I'd say it's almost completely irrelevant how tall the guy is.
Yeah, and I think you can use the same line of logic when evaluating athletes in other sports. Like I mentioned earlier, Russell Wilson and Drew Brees. You take a look at Russell Wilson in college, and there's absolutely no way that you can say that guy is not going to be successful at the next level, regardless of his size. He's just a football player. So it does come down to the numbers. It comes down to the pedigree. And baseball general managers, like general managers in other sports, get themselves into a lot of trouble when they invest money and time in projects. Not necessarily the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think also that proclamations sometimes break down. I mean, even when I think about back to the Pittsburgh idea of like everyone should have a two-seamer, well, there are plenty of pitchers out there who have bad two-seamers, and some of them have even done really good by throwing away their two-seamer. Colin McHugh had a big breakout last year. He just stopped throwing his two-seamer and just started throwing the four-seamer more. So, I think a lot of times proclamations like, well, we want tall pitchers, they don't work out because, there are the Billy Wagners, there are the Marcus Stromans, there are guys that are shorter that do well. And you're just going to miss them if you make a big proclamation like that.
Right. It's tough to try to fit everyone into the same box.
Yeah.
Quickly, you are also have a love of I guess in the off season you have a love of beer, and you also are a contributor on a website called beergraphs.com. And so I have to ask you, what the heck and how do you exactly value beers above replacement bar? what is going on there?
I actually started Beergraphs, and the idea is just to try and slice and dice available numbers out there in a slightly different way to maybe get better at our biases and try to more correctly value beer, I guess. A beer above replacement, the idea is that there is a locally available beer that is acceptable to you, that you could get at any time, that we should be judging beers against, above and beyond that beer. So basically, like in baseball, there's a replacement player, which is the quadruple A guy that you can sign at any moment for a minor league contract. I think When I think of replacement beers, I think of Stella Artois, to some extent, and it changes a lot locally. So we're looking into making this a local thing, but to some extent, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale out here on the West Coast is a replacement level pale ale just because, there's so many great pale ales out here. And, the Sierra Nevada is everywhere. So, that helps you better judge beers because now you're talking about something, you're talking about, oh, well, I could get the Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, so how much better is this beer than Sierra Nevada?
It's interesting. So you first have to establish what the replacement beer is. And then once you do that, then you can start to evaluate local beers in all sorts of different regions. Last question I have for you is, in your travels around the different ballparks in the United States, is there one stadium that's beer selection stands out above the rest?
Oh, yes. Yes. San Diego. I haven't yet been to Seattle, which is supposedly either best or second best, but San Diego is amazing because not only is the San Diego beer scene amazing, but they've really incorporated it into the park. And so you've got Green Flash and Ballast Point and a lot of these big heavy hitter San Diego breweries there, but then you also have just really good beer bars in and around the stadium. It's just it's a really great place. You can get big old bombers of interesting semi-rare beers to have while you're watching a game. It's a unique experience. San Francisco is pretty good too because there's a bar attached to the park that actually has really rare beers, has a really good beer selection. It's just that it's a bar that's attached, so you kind of have to, you can go in and out, but you kind of have to almost leave the park to get your beer and then come back.
You know, you're making me real thirsty here. that's about all the time we have for right now. You know, Saris, thanks for taking the time. We'll have to talk again sometime soon and talk beer.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.